Well, in this seminar, March 20, we are going to proceed from yesterday's topic, which was a general definition and description of the mental plane, this mental, material mental plane, actually being material existence. It actually is that place in which the spirit soul is attached to and involved with the material nature. So that we talked about yesterday and described that condition of consciousness. Now, today, following yesterday's description of the mental plane, we want to present basic forms of philosophy and religion which arise from this mental plane. So, as I think you know, the mind has two main functions, sankalpa and vikalpa. This is Rocha. Let's...
Your preaching is having practical effect.
It's taken a long time. So there are two basic functions of the mind, sankalpa, vikalpa. Sankalpa means acceptance. And out of this, obviously, attachment is becoming very strong. And vikalpa is the opposite of that. It is also attachment, actually, but negative attachment, rejection. So there are philosophies that exemplify these two functions of mind. And so we're going to be taking, in our reference to philosophies today, what we can call classical philosophies coming from India. So, to exemplify sankalpa vikalpa, there is Charvak and there is Buddhism. Now, the basic conception of reality is pretty much the same in both. I'm not going to spend too much time with Charvak because really, that's not even a philosophy. I mean, we define philosophy already, and this just isn't up to the mark. It's just a doctrine of sense enjoyment. But basically, both Buddhism and Charvak are accepting these impressions. We mentioned samskaras, so the impressions in our consciousness of this external world, our experience of this external world. So these both philosophies are basically accepting those impressions as being all that there is. In some forms of Buddhism, then you have the option of negating that and coming to all that there isn't. You see, but when we, in other words, shunya is all that there isn't. But as far as this world is all that there is, in terms of isness, there's nothing else. So that's Buddhism, and that's also Charvak philosophy. So that means both are what? Materialistic. I remember having a discussion with His Holiness Jayadwaita Maharaj. And somehow in the discussion, Buddhism came up. And Maharaj made a remark, I don't remember it exactly, this was so many years ago, but he made a remark that would count Buddhism within spirituality. And I said, Maharaj, I can't accept this, I'm sorry. Buddhism is materialism. And finally, it was kind of a compromise. And Maharaj was saying, well, this is the way people think about Buddhism. I said, all right. In that way, you know, they have so many ideas what is spiritual life. So that, if you want to use the word spiritual in that way, okay. But as far as the philosophy of Buddhism is concerned, it is materialism. And Charvak is famously materialism. Srila Prabhupada calls it that.
Excuse me. Yeah. For the sake of our understanding, could you define what you mean by materialism?
Materialism is, yeah.
Because different...
That's true also, the good. Ways. Well, this is ontological materialism, okay? Ontological. Ontological is referring to what is there. What is. So, because we can have ethical materialism. That would be another form. That would mean that, for example, we see in Hinduism, all these mundane religions, Christianity. So there is some doctrine that we are soul and there is a God. There is some idea of a spiritual dimension. But as far as the practical life, everything is geared to sense enjoyment. Materialism in that sense, that we're working for money. Our whole concern is just this life. But there's God, and if we go to church or temple, He'll help us in our material affairs. So that we might call ethical materialism. As far as the, you know, the ethics, this moral strivings of the human being, they're materialistic. But ontological materialism means that matter is all there is. I mean, there's no category of spirit. There's no other dimension, you see, beyond this material existence. There's only this material existence, or there's nothing. That's Buddhism. The Buddhists come with, or there is nothing.
There is nothing.
The Charvaks say there's only material existence, and they don't want to, you know, even consider any alternative. The Buddhists say, because, you know, we'll get, I'm going to offer you an explanation of the four main schools of Buddhism in just a moment, which have been analyzed in Vedanta Sutra and by the commentaries of the Bhashyakars, the great commentators on Vedanta. So we'll see that some Buddhists also lean to there is this material world, and others Buddhists lean to there is not. But both are materialists. So sankalpa vikalpa, the two main functions of the material mind, remembering again, this was the subject matter yesterday, so they come out in the forms of these philosophies. So Charvak, I think, I really don't want to talk about that. Here is sense gratification, get it. You see, go after it, go for it, as they say. And you'll fulfill your purpose in life by that. And when you're dead, you're dead. So a success in life is how much one is enjoyed. So Buddhism, vikalpa. We have to admit that they're a bit more intelligent. In that, they have bhoga tyag. So, after bhog, then tyag or disgust comes up. So they're on that stage at least. They recognize that this sense gratification is not the success of the human life. And so they seek nirvana, the cessation of material existence. Or, as we will hear, there's a synonym for nirvana, nirodha, which means destruction. Destruction of the conception of the self. So, now we will talk about the four main schools. Now, there, I can't tell you how many sects of Buddhism there are. Famously, Buddhism is divided into Hinayana, lesser vehicle, which is this Theravada that we see in Southeast Asia, and Ceylon, Sri Lanka. And then there's Mahayana, the greater vehicle, which is in Tibet, China, Korea, Japan. Or sometimes the Tibetan form of Buddhism in particular is given even a third category, this Vajrayana, Vajra means lightning. So this is Tantrism. And the idea is the Vajra idea, lightning, they're actually asserting that there is consciousness, and we'll be talking about that. There is consciousness, and this consciousness can be made very powerful, like lightning, by some tantric process. This form of Buddhism, Vajrayana, is, this is the doorway to Advaita Vedanta. This is actually we're talking about the caterpillar moving between two leaves, so this is the bridge. Their conception, they have even scriptures like the Lankavatar Sutra, in which the state of nirvana is described with words like Brahman. And the Buddha is addressed by the name Vishnu. So the historians of this will say there was a sharing of influence. There was the Buddhists were very, at that stage, influenced by Hinduism or the Vedas, and conversely, the Brahmanas were being very influenced by the Buddhists. And Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, said that now we see these Buddhism as distinct from Hinduism, but when Buddhism was in India, it was part of the total spiritual scene. Again, that word spiritual, religious scene. So the distinction that we're aware of now was not then.
That's what the scholars said.
Well, that's what Prabhupada said.
Oh, so. I was just thinking that they were... you see, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, presumably speaking from the vantage point, this comment that Vedamani Abodvaita Nastik, that comment that the Buddhists are considered atheists because they don't follow the Vedas. And I would have thought that within those who follow the Vedas, they would accept each other at least to discuss with, but not Buddhists.
Well, obviously the dividing point was Sankaracharya. So my understanding of what Prabhupada said, he's talking about the pre-Shankara period. So Buddhism was another form of moksha dharma. And as we'll see, and even scholars admit that within Buddhist philosophy, one can see that there's a lot that is has been assumed from the Upanishads. They've changed terminology because that's what philosophers do. They sort of separate their philosophy by adjusting terminology, having special terms. But basic concepts are coming from elsewhere. So this is there. So anyway, yes, Buddhism, it is some very primitive, from the Vedic point of view, attempt at moksha dharma, at achieving moksha. So, getting back to my original point. There are these different trends in Buddhism that I just mentioned, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, and then within them, there are so many sects. I don't think they could be counted. I know from a couple visits I've made to Japan, there are so many different kinds of Buddhist sects there. I think in every Buddhist country, there's so many different branches. So I'm not even going to, but I know very little about those particular sects, and I think it's a waste of time to talk about them. What I'm going to be talking about here are schools of thought. These are actually the philosophies of Buddhism, and these philosophies may encompass many sects. The many sects are falling under these different flags of views of the Buddhist philosophy. And then they have within those sects some minor adjustments that distinguish their understanding from others. So, oh, here we have another interruption. This is like always at this time. Falls right in about 10:30 every day, someone comes. So, first we'll be talking about there's four main schools, and right now we're going to look at two of them, Vaibhashika and Sautrantika. So the doctrine of Vaibhashika is direct realism. And the doctrine of Sautrantika is representationalism. I will explain that further in a few moments. But right now we just want to talk about the basic conceptions that these two schools have. They're basically the same conceptions. So they both hold that all that exists are five, what they call in their terminology, skandhas. And this word skandha in meaning is the same as kosha. So you see, this is something that has been borrowed from, something referring to the Upanishadic and Vedantic doctrine. In Vedanta, the soul has these five koshas or coverings. So in these schools of Buddhism, there are five skandhas. The thing is that the five skandhas are not covering anything. The five skandhas, which are to be removed, are actually, they make up the living entity. And once the skandhas are taken away, then there's nothing left. That's the difference, because Buddhist philosophy is anatma. They reject the Vedic doctrine of Atma, soul. So these five skandhas, first is rupa, which as you know means form. This rupa category includes earth, water, fire, air. And you're expecting me to say ether, but no. We'll come to ether in a little bit. But within ether there are forms. So the forms within ether, that is the fifth. So earth, water, fire, air, and the forms in ether, but not the holy Akash itself. That's the first, rupa. Then the next four, they're all pertaining to inner or subtle phenomena. So, vijnana, and obviously this is a word, Sanskrit word taken from Vedas. The Buddhists have given their own spin on this word. Vijnana, to them, means the stream of consciousness. The stream of the ego. Just like a river, it's flowing along. It is not, that flowing you see, means that it is not actually substantially existing as a steady thing, a steady entity, a steady tattva, as we understand consciousness, as the energy of the soul. The soul is eternal. This idea of a river, just like in Greece also, there were philosophers like Heraclitus. So Heraclitus, he said that you can't step into the same river twice. You step into the river once, and if you go back to it again, it's a different river. You understand? Because the river is flowing. So it cannot be the same river that it was when you went in the river before. And then he had a disciple, Cratylus, who said, he took it further, you can't step into the same river once. Because the river is always flowing, so you step into it, and what you entered 1 minute is 1 second is gone. So the river itself is changing around you. So you can't even step into the same river once. That's his point. So this is what they mean by stream of consciousness. You see, it's something flowing along that is ever changing, and they have this doctrine of, in Buddhism, it's essential to Buddhism, chanikavad. Which everything, chanika means, Panditji, you know? Chanika? You know this word?
Moment.
Means moment. Chanikavad means the philosophy of momentarianism. I just made up a word. Anyway, the idea that everything is changing moment by moment by moment, and there is no background to it. There's no steady background. Everything, including consciousness too, is changing. It's like film. In a film, there's a succession of pictures. And light is projected through it. And because the film is running, you have motion picture in front of you. But this is motion picture without film or projector. Just motion picture. Without a background to it. So this is how they view begin a consciousness. It's a stream. Then there's Vedana, which means this is the third skanda, the perception of pleasure and pain. The fourth skanda is Sanja, which means names and words, language. And the fifth skanda is Samskara, which means impressions. Particularly emotional impressions that we identify, say, a person or a thing in our minds with pleasure, pain. So when we see this person, someone we like, then that immediately is giving us the impression of joy. If we see another person whom we don't like, we're always having trouble with, and just by seeing that person, the opposite impression comes up in the mind. So these are five skandhas. The view of the world, and this is general to all schools of Buddhism, how they understand the world to be, can be summed up in this phrase, ever-changing equilibrium. Now, everything is always changing. Nothing is steady, but it appears to be steady because there's a kind of equilibrium. And we can... again, this is only, you know, it's only half a philosophy, you know, because they're only concerned with perceptions, really. Buddhism is a form of anuman which only deals with pratyaksha, and there's nothing more. So therefore, it's only half philosophy. Because to really explain our sense impressions, there must be metaphysics. There must be, something beyond that is maintaining this. But they don't allow that in their doctrine. So this ever-changing equilibrium, you can just to get a picture, this is from, again, we find this in Bhagavatam and other Vedic references, this example. But again, in Buddhism, it's only half there, the example. So you know the example of the moon reflected on water. So this is, the Buddhists have taken away the moon in the sky. There's only the water, ever-changing, the waves, and then the scattered moon, breaking up, coming, coalescing, breaking up, coalescing. But why that should be, there's no explanation. So this is ever-changing equilibrium. You see? You shouldn't become attached, but then there's no alternative to it either. So therefore, in all Buddhism, all schools of Buddhism, there's this idea of, you see, it's all voidism, even though I mentioned the other day, there is one of these four schools is specifically called Shunyavad, because they come to a very extreme conclusion. I mean, from the point of view of the other schools of Buddhism, Shunyavad is extremism. But what Shunyavad really is doing, the Shunyavad philosophers, all they did was really expose the essence of Buddhism and say, this is the essence, so we should just go for that. So in all schools of Buddhism, there's this idea of emptiness. You see, this is going on, this ever-changing equilibrium. Everything's ever-changing, so you should not become attached to it. So therefore, you have to empty your mind. This is their meditation, to empty the mind of its attachments to this world. And then, then there's these different conceptions of what nirvana will be. If all there is this world, then one idea of nirvana would be you kind of just merge into the world. You lose your sense of selfness. And, the body is there going on, but it's just a robot. There's the self has been annihilated. So
in the meantime, the body is going on enjoying all kinds of inspiration, but I'm not attached. I'm not this.
Yes, I'm not there. This is, you can see it's a very strange philosophy. And then they aim at Nirodha. Nirodha, as I said, destruction. So, but still, in this Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, there is a kind of material goal that they keep in mind, even when they're aiming in their meditation at destruction. And I've already mentioned it, the Akash, without form. You see, Akash, that ethereal element without any form attached to it. Then for the Sautrantikas and Vaibhashikas, that is the nirvana, you see. So to sort of merge into that, Prabhupada said that by their meditation they want to dismantle their body. They take it apart in their meditation until the only thing that is left is Akash without any form. So Akash is still matter. So now, I caution you, that is the conception of nirvana, or shunya, as it were, of these two particular schools of Buddhism. So then there's a third school, Yogacara, or it's otherwise known as Vijnanabad. Before I jump ahead, I need to talk about the difference between these two schools. I didn't mention that yet. These two schools have, as I said, the same basic conceptions of what's going on in existence. Now, the difference between them is this. It's over the question of memory. So, if everything is just this ever-changing equilibrium, just everything flashing on, flashing off, including, as we heard, even consciousness, then why is there memory? How can there be memory? Because that's something persisting from moment to moment to moment. So Sautrantika school tries to account for memory with a special turn of doctrine, which then distinguishes this school from the Vaibhashika schools, which just, these are the Theravada Buddhists, actually, Vaibhashika. They're just, this is all there is, you just meditate, nullify it, finished. So the Sautrantikas, they have this doctrine which is called, the Vaibhashikas, remember, direct realism. This is all there is. Sautrantikas, representationalism. That we do not perceive this world directly. Our experience of the world is not the world itself. So, what we're perceiving is, again, even in the West, they come up with this too. It is just impressions of the world in our consciousness. So the world is something else, and what we take to be the world are the impressions that the energies of the world are making in our consciousness. So then the Sautrantikas are saying, what we're remembering are these impressions. The impressions remain in the consciousness, and that becomes memory. But the problem is, as I've already explained, that the Sautrantikas also adhere to this stream of consciousness. So the very consciousness that they say is being impressed by the world is turning off and on at every moment. Or not off, yes, it is. Going off means it ceases to exist. And then another consciousness comes up for an instant and then it's gone.
Almost identical with the same thing.
Yeah,
by chance.
It's just the way things are. They have the Buddhists have this term suchness. That's suchness, just the way things are, and you can't go beyond it. So if consciousness is just turning off and on like that, then why would impressions stay the same in each instant of consciousness? Why? How is it possible that an impression would remain? What would be the force that would keep the impression in the consciousness if it is shutting down completely and then starting up again, not from a hard disk, which is retaining information, but just out of nothing? So then the Sautrantika philosophy is also falling short of a reasonable explanation for memory. So therefore, going on, there's the Yogachar or Vijnanavad philosophy, which is subjective idealism. So they're taking this, what we just heard in Sautrantika philosophy, further. They're saying actually the objective world doesn't exist. There is only consciousness. And everything is just a dream. So we're just dreaming, and then this is bringing us into what in the West is called solipsism. I explained that actually the only existence is me, and you other people are just created by my mind. So now the borderline between this and insanity is very difficult to draw. Because there are people that locked in the mad now, so who are realized in this philosophy. They're very advanced in this philosophy, that they're the only ones who exist. And they get shut up in the nut house. So this is the problem with the solipsism. That if everything is a product of my mind, then, why this then? Why this world? Why this world full of creations of my mind who don't agree that they're products of my mind? You see, I've created a whole world full of people who are not going to agree. I mean, if anyone in that world would agree, then they're just as crazy as I am. Oh yes, I am the product of your mind. It would be very hard to find another person who would would agree. So practically everyone in the world is going to disagree. Why did my mind create such a world that doesn't acknowledge that, in other words, I'm God. This is the philosophy. I'm God. But God has created this world, and no one in the world is going to agree that this person is God. Now the real God has created this material world. Well, yeah, there are many atheists in this world, that's true, but still there are many, many believers in God too. I mean, even in this world, the real God has many, many believers. But if I declare that I'm God and everything is creation of my mind, there's not going to be anyone to agree with that. So, except fools. I guess there are some who do that, Sai Baba and so on. But, so, yes. And then another question is, if everything's a creation of my mind only, then why can't I change the world totally? You see? Why do I have to live in Salem every day? And why, if I want to go to Hollywood, Bollywood or Hollywood, which is supposed to be the very exciting places, why do I have to board a train or get on an airplane, get an American visa? Why can't I just change Salem into Mumbai or Los Angeles or a world of my total, my own invention completely? But I don't have this. So this is, absurdity. So then the last installment of Buddhist philosophy is Shunyavad, which comes to the conclusion that existence itself is a contradiction. Because if you say existence, it means something that actually exists. Something that actually is. So what they're saying is all this argument that's going on in previous schools to establish, it's like this or like that, is all ridiculous because nothing actually exists. And they give this example of seed and tree. They say that when there is a tree, if you say this tree exists because of the seed, well, where's the seed? See, that seed was destroyed as soon as the tree existed. Then if you want to make from the tree a wooden wagon, you do that and then the tree no longer exists. So the appearance of things is contradictory, you see? If you say something appears and it exists, it's all full of contradiction. There's no causation, in other words, this is their point. You cannot establish any causation. And because there's no causation, then there's also no destruction. You see? Things are neither created nor destroyed. Everything is just void. This is a nice poem. Neither created nor destroyed, all is simply void. So these are the fruits of mental speculation. All these are thoughts arising from the conditioned mind. And these philosophies are nastika. They are sheer mental speculation. Then we have speculative astika philosophies, which draw authority from the Vedas, take elements from the Vedas, but then run them through the butter churn of mental speculation and churn up something else. Like you put milk in and churn it and get something else. So that's what they've done. So these are the famous Saddarshan, six systems of philosophy. So I want to go through them. And this is an overview, a summary. I'm not sure. It's up to you. If you, you know, I'll see you by your questions if you really want in later meetings of the seminar to go into detail into these philosophies. But they are quite boring. Yes, and stupid. So Nyaya is the first of the six. Nyaya is logic, the systematic attempt to establish correct knowledge by what is called anvishiki, or critical study. And basically, the systematic study is about words, you see. Because as they say in Western philosophy also, like there's a philosopher, Wittgenstein, who says that words are the vehicles of thoughts. You see, how can you think about anything absent of words? You can't. Try to think of anything with having no words in your mind. You'll quickly see it's not possible. So, therefore, our development of knowledge, our search for understanding, it is based on language. That's an absolute. So, logicians then, their main concern is the meaning of words and the correct use of words to come to correct conclusions. This is the concern of Nyaya, and the word logic, into which the Western world, English word, and so many other Western languages have a form of this word. This is coming from Greek logos, which means word. In the Bible is originally, or the Greek New Testament is originally Greek language. And there's this phrase in the New Testament, in the beginning there was the word. So this word in the original Bible is logos. So logic is concerned with words. And Nyaya, there's also something positive, in a sense, in these Astika philosophy. Astika means they accept the Vedas, and they accept that there is an existence, an eternal existence, an eternal reality, which is the subject matter of the Vedas. Whereas Buddhism and Charvak rejects that. So, the six systems represent a development or an approach to understanding this reality. So, the contribution of Nyaya, we can say, in this search, because these philosophies are for mental speculators. So, for speculators, the contribution that Nyaya makes is that it establishes the basic categories of discussion of the absolute truth, which are praman, or evidence, and they have the same evidences as we have, pratyaksha, anuman, shabda, plus also comparison, upamana. And then there's prameya. Prameya means principles. For the Nyaya philosophers, there's 12 principles, which are they call the 12 objects of knowledge. Tattva-gyan, this is a category in Nyaya, which means knowledge of the truth, the real truth, beyond what we think is true in our ordinary understanding of things. Liberation, that is a goal in Nyaya. And finally, God too. But their conception of God is mundane. Nimittikarana, that he is... We discussed these causations already. So the efficient cause, the one who puts together the ingredients of the world, that is God. So then questions will come up. What about this God? What about these ingredients that he's putting together? What is the real? And then the Nyayas, the logicians, they don't go that far in their philosophy. So, therefore, closely related to Nyaya is Vaisheshika. Vaisheshika is simply a step further of the Nyaya philosophy. So Vaisheshika means atomic theory. Nyaya is the philosophy that is said to be propounded by the sage Gautama, and there was another sage, Kanada, who propounded this Vaisheshika. So much of the basic categories and conceptions in Vaisheshika are the same as in Nyaya, but of course they're more concerned with atoms. Nyaya says God creates the world from atoms and doesn't say any more. Vaisheshika goes into this question to try to explain fully how the world comes out of atoms. And so they have this idea that God releases the atoms from some stage of potency, and then the atoms by themselves come together, and they have this idea of atoms combining into two and three, and then those combine, you know, from atoms to sort of molecular arrangements, and then out of all that, the whole world comes about. But this also can be easily knocked down. It doesn't go far enough. But we can say again, if there's a positive contribution in Vaisheshika, it's establishing, making very clear that the forms of this world are temporary, that actually this world is an illusion. Because what they're saying is that what's really there is simply atoms. You see, the atoms are real, but the things that they come together to form, that is temporary, and therefore, if we are thinking that they are real and we become attached to them, that is illusion. So the Vaisheshika philosophy at least is doing this, is encouraging one to become detached from the forms of this world by remembering that they're just atoms, and everything in this world will change. So then, as an attempt to further explain the creation of the world, there's Sankhya philosophy. So Sankhya philosophy is proposing Purusha, the soul, the spirit, and Prakriti, material nature. The atoms are, of course, within Prakriti, but really the principles that are causing the combination of atoms into forms are the three gunas, the three modes of material nature. So the Sankhya philosophy has a very elaborate explanation of the modes and how they work. And up to a certain point, it's the same as our philosophy, up to a certain point. And what is that point? The point of God, again. So the real Sankhya philosophy, Bhagavat Sankhya philosophy, is taught by Kapila in third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. But there's an atheist Kapila. So he's in this atheistic philosophy, God or Ishwara is really nothing more than a certain jiva who has become very great somehow or other. And then that'll be the next philosophy. Yoga is supposed to reveal how one can achieve this exalted state by austerity, self-control, and all of that. And then one achieves a liberation in which one is becoming the master of this Prakriti. Then, and the positive contribution of yoga, well, I'll say first the positive contribution of Sankhya is this doctrine of the modes of nature. and how the whole material creation is coming out, the forms of material creation are rising out of the modes. But of course, the modes are overwhelming the mind. So yoga is taking it a step further, that we have to strengthen the mind, strengthen consciousness by discipline, and in this way become masters of the modes of nature. Then the Mimamsa, Karma Mimamsa philosophy is saying, actually, that powerful mind, mind endowed with all yogic powers, should be applied to Vedic mantra, Vedic vidhi, Vedic method. And in this way, one becomes not only master, one becomes enjoyer. You see, because the Vedas are revealing the heavenly realms of higher sense enjoyment. So if one becomes master, you know, masters everything through yoga, then he can manipulate the Vedas. He knows how to chant the Vedas properly, and therefore he can go up to those heavenly planets. And even if one has to, even if we say, but the situation up there is not eternal, well, even if you come down, then you come back down to earth, and again perform so many sacrifices, and go back up. So in this way, one can enjoy on earth also, performing sacrifices as a Karmakanda Brahmana, and then one can go to heaven. And in Vaisheshika philosophy, there's no Mimamsa philosophy, Karma Mimamsa, there's no end to this world. This is the thing. They don't. There's no understanding of Mahapralaya. So one just goes on and on and on and on this way, performing sacrifices, going up to heaven, enjoying there, coming back down, performing more sacrifices. You see. So then the Vedanta philosophy is saying that no, this world is not eternal. That eternal thing that we should achieve is Brahman, and Brahman is transcendental. Now, within Vedanta philosophy, there are different schools, and they have been nicely summarized by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur in his commentary on the last verse of the second to the last verse. Now, let me see. No. Yes, verse 60. This is the last verse of the Brahma Samhita. So he summarizes the different Vedantic doctrines. So let's hear. Certain thinkers conclude that the non-differentiated Brahman is the ultimate entity, and by undergoing self-delusion, Vivarta exhibits the consciousness of differentiation. So this is the classical Mayavad, Vivartavad of Shankaracharya. This is impersonalism. Then another form of impersonalism, or the limiting principle itself, Maya, when it is limited, is the phenomenal world and is itself the Brahman in its unlimited position. This is like the doctrine of the Shaktas, the worshippers of Durga, of the goddess, Devi. They say Devi is the ultimate principle. And she is Brahman, and she is the world. Or the Brahman is the substance, and this phenomenal world is the reflection. But this conception of Brahman is also impersonal. Or everything is an illusion of the jiva. It's interesting also to note, these are four types of impersonal Vedanta. It's interesting to note that in Europe, German idealism. There are also four branches of German idealism, and they very much resemble this description. I was amazed that I don't know if I can remember all the names, but there was one Fichte, Schopenhauer, Hegel, and Schelling. Yes, these are the four main idealists. So one of them is saying that the world is coming out of something else, a primordial will. The self that we experience ourselves is actually something else, a primordial will. And we have willed ourselves into this state of bondage, and now we have to become free, and then we will return to that sort of mystical state of pure will. Hegel, he's the one who says that everything is this, more or less, it's matter. But matter is evolving to spirit. Matter and spirit are the same thing. They're just phases of the same substance. But matter, what we experience now as matter, is gradually evolving to spirit. And so one day it will become pure spirit. So this is similar to the second doctrine. The Brahman is a substance and this phenomenal world is a reflection. This is something like Schopenhauer's philosophy. He wrote a book called The World as Will and Reflection. So what we're experiencing of the world now is simply reflection. And it's a kind of, you know, an unhappy reflection. We have to rid ourselves of that and come to our pure position as, more or less again, God. We are God. And then everything is an illusion of the jiva. So this is a fourth. The jiva is putting himself in illusion. So then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati goes on. He says, some think that Godhead is evidently a separate entity, jiva is another different entity, and the phenomenal world, although it is a singular principle, exists separately as an eternal independent entity. Or Godhead is a substantive entity, and all other entities as chit and achit attributes are one in principle. This is Dvaita and Vishishta Dvaita, which are Vaishnava Vedanta's philosophy. Some suppose that by the force of inconceivable potency, sometimes the monistic and sometimes the dualistic principle is realized as the truth. This is Dvaita Dvaita of Nimbarkacharya. Some again arrive at the conclusion that the theory of the non-dual minus all potency is meaningless, whence Brahman is the one eternally unalloyed entity vested with the pure potency, Shuddhadvaita, Vishnu Swami, and then Vallabhacharya. So now the Vaishnava Vedanta viewpoints are being mentioned here. So the very next paragraph begins this way. These speculations have originated from Veda, relying on the support of the Vedanta Sutra. In these speculations, although there is no truth that holds good in all positions, there is yet a certain measure of truth. So in other words, even the Vedanta philosophy is not really the absolute truth. So in his conclusion, in this, to Brahma Sangita, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he's saying that what Brahma is telling, what the Lord is telling Brahma, the philosophy, the point of view that he's giving to Lord Brahma is a chincha beda abeda tattva. And this is not a philosophy, actually. In other words, this is not some idea that has been generated from the mind referring to the Vedas. But this is reality. And the process for realizing this is purified consciousness. Therefore, the Shikshashtakam is beginning with what? Cheto Darpana Marjana. That the mind has to be completely cleansed. And this way the Absolute Truth can be understood. So one may wonder about the great acharyas who have introduced these four philosophies. So my understanding, because as I told you, sometimes I will present what I think. So, my understanding is that Nimbarkacharya, Vishnu Swami, Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, as we see, as Vedanta Acharyas, their audience that they were preaching to were Brahmanas. Brahmanas who are prone to being misled. Many of them were already at the time of Ramanuja, Madhvacharya. It is actually said Nimbarkacharya is long before Shankaracharya. He appeared at the end of the Dwapar Yuga, so he's actually the first of the four Vaishnavacharyas. Vishnu Swami also appeared, said to appear, I think he may have been just after, around the time of Shankaracharya. So he's also quite old. Whether just before Shankaracharya, just after, I'm not sure, around the same time. But anyway, Brahmana, you see, Brahmana is also a material designation, and they have their propensity to become enamored by speculation. They have their conventions of how things are to be discussed. These six systems we talked about already, so they follow Nyaya and these systematic step-by-step procedures. And this is mundane. So these acharyas, great acharyas, came to establish Vaishnavism among these brahmanas, employing the pre-existing rules of logic and argument and reference and all of that. And their mission was to make the Vaishnava doctrine acceptable to this Brahmana class, so that they would maintain worship of the Lord in society. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he appears well into Kali Yuga. His philosophy, again, is the philosophy of pure realization, which comes through pure devotional service to the Lord. And it, while it is expressed as philosophy, it does not rely upon philosophical conventions. So, Mahaprabhu's philosophy is an expression of love of God. And that the means of realizing this love of God is not actually by thinking, by anuman, but by chanting Hare Krishna without offense. So therefore, the Achincha Beda Beda philosophy is not within this category of speculation. It's clearly stated by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So it is now almost 11:30. So we covered a lot of material. So I'm going to stop here and see if you have any questions. Yes?
Six systems of philosophy, they historically they evolved from each other, or they were just separately invented by the sages, and do they, each of the system refers to other systems also, or they're just separate in themselves? without connection to others. They also believe, or they also accept mentioning the other systems and refute them like Vedanta does.
Well, first of all, these are schools of Vedic knowledge. So Bhagavatam is the complete commentary, the ultimate commentary on Vedic knowledge. And we find in the Bhagavatam the subject matters of these six philosophies are all there. Everything is explained. The subject matters, that chapter, calculation of time from the atom, is there. Everything. So, these six schools were originally departments of study of different aspects of Vedic knowledge, like in a university. The university is one institution, but you have history department, you have mathematics department, you have different departments. So particularly in Kali Yuga, this is the age of quarrel. So then there's friction. There is disagreement. So this is what has happened in the Kali Yuga, that these six schools of Vedic study began to quarrel with one another. And due to the influence of quarrel, then actually they lost really their real understanding and just became debating institutions. So the original philosophy is the Bhagavad philosophy that we find in Srimad Bhagavatam. And then within that, you know, universal knowledge, there are different departments of study, and different sages became masters of different departments. But the this breaking up into six separate schools of competing viewpoints, this is a particular feature of the Kali Yuga. Yes?
These six systems, mostly they are atheistic. So how do they accept Vedas? What do they say from where Vedas are originating and why they...
Well, they all say Vedas are Paurusheya, not created by man. And atheistic means, it doesn't mean that they reject God. Even the atheistic Sankhya philosophy is sort of non-committal. In other words, there is some room for an Ishvara, but the way they define the Ishvara, it's not the God that we know. So this is again, you see, this is all the result of being on the mental plane. You see? When one is on the mental plane, the material mind works to make everything so-called logical, so-called acceptable to everyone, you see? In other words, the material mind renders everything material. So God, they have to make God reasonable. And so that God that they present is very distorted and crippled in comparison with the Bhagavad presentation. So Bhagavad philosophy, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy, it is God conscious, you see? What can you say? It's not philosophy about God. It is God conscious. It is God's own philosophy, God himself, how he presents himself. It's not a way to help some class, intellectual brahmanas with all of their, philosophical issues, tangles, to help them understand God better in their terms. But God is revealed in our philosophy.
It could be said that in these philosophies, God is a component, a philosophical necessity that's just put in there. but they don't, there's no attachment or love of God or even desire to know anything more about Him.
Yes. That's a very good point. Because mundane philosophy is mechanistic. You see, because they're so, you see, they're so, starting with Nyaya. Nyaya has all these categories and they're just fascinated. This is their fascination, have all these categories and see how it's all working together in a very logical way. And the other six systems are just developments of this basic principle. So therefore, mechanistic means impersonal. So the Vedas, you know, Vedas, if you follow the Vedas, you have to have God. But He just becomes, maybe the biggest cog in the machinery. Okay, this is a very big cog and many other cogs, but still, it is just one component. Like the Sankhya, God and nature and their Purusha Prakriti. And they're more or less on the same, there's nothing above, they're on the same level. You see? And then one of these Purushas, he may be the Ishvara in some, by gaining so many mystic powers. But there's this other tattva, the Prakriti. And she's, according to their system, she's independent. And there's just some, as they tried to explain, some sort of mutual attraction between Purusha and Prakriti. They just sort of voluntarily come together. And when they come together, then by their, by this mechanistic system, things happen. The material world comes out.
that Gita verse, Asatyam Apratishtam Te?
Yes.
That specifically refers to Sankhya or Kimanyar Kama Hitukam?
Well, Prabhupada says the philosophy of the Asuras. And
that Aparaspara Sambhutam Kimanyar Kama Hitukam exactly fits that Prakriti Purusha.
Yeah, I think what it is that Lord Krishna has analyzed the demoniac attitude, and when you have a Sankhya philosopher or anyone, someone adhering to these schools who has that same attitude, who's a demon, at heart an atheist, then this is how he's going to present his philosophy, how he'll present even he's supposedly a teacher of Vedic knowledge, but it will come out. This is what I see, because there are so many philosophies that fit that pattern Krishna has presented. So it's this world-enjoying asuric approach. They want to enjoy the world and they want no impediment to their enjoyment. So therefore, God has to be rendered impotent. If there's a God at all, then make Him, just like some necessary component in the total mechanism. And the purpose of the mechanism is our enjoyment. So, if there is a God, this is like in the Karma Mimamsa philosophy, if there is a God, He's just there to answer our, to respond to our rituals that we're performing. And actually, He's under our control.
He has to give results.
Yeah, He has to give results. We're doing all the, all the real work here by being very expert. And God's up there and He has to, if He's there. In other words, they come to the point where, that this is the atheistic Kapila, and his sutra. This is what he said about the Ishvara, that he's not necessary. He doesn't actually say that there is no Ishvara, but he says he's not necessary to our system. So he may be there, may not be there. In this way, they retain some aura of being Vedic. All right, And here in India, you meet so many of these kind of people. Yes. God may be there, that is all right. But He's not important, not essential. And this is the clear difference between the Bhagavad philosophy and all others. The philosophy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, even in comparison to the other Vaishnava Vedanta. Because although they are clearly theistic, but still they're trying to frame God within some, logical system. Like, and then they argue, like, you know, Ramanuja's explanation is comparing God to the soul and the material world to the body. This is the example to understand this Vashishta Dvaita. It's one Advaita in the sense of one totality, but there are distinctions within it. So then the Dvaitavadis, they object that if you make God the soul of the body, but the soul in the body suffers. And God is transcendental, He is full of bliss. So therefore, Dvaita. Therefore, there is an absolute difference. And, you know, God is, and so they also, in the Dvaita philosophy, there's this sort of, it resembles the Samkhya conclusion of material nature is sort of put off on the side, and somehow she's there working. They say that material nature is the ingredient cause of the material world. This is their insistence, because they want to keep God in the transcendental position, so things didn't really, it's not, you can see how, you know, their adherence to their logical doctrines sort of interferes with the pure understanding. To maintain this dvaita, we have to say that the elements of the material creation do not originate in God, because that would be bringing him too close in touch with the material nature.
They object when we say that God enjoys creation. It has nothing to do with creation.
Yes.
Just like a play. Just like when you speak, you move kind of automatically. This is how he creates. He is creator, but really no any desire to, not enjoyment.
Give some example,
like a water. Do you break water? It's like completely different. Just it doesn't mean it's a sign. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, you mentioned those four German philosophers, and actually, I lost the point. I cannot remember. What they were representing according to this Satdarshana system, was it Vedanta or?
The four German philosophers?
Yeah, because you were just giving some.
Well, I was just correlating. Yeah. That, actually, what I'm saying is that from this summary of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, four kinds of impersonal Vedanta, I discovered in my reading there is a resemblance. And I'm not taking it any further than this. There's just a general resemblance to the four basic types of German idealism. So it just means that impersonalism follows a pattern, you see, and can manifest in different places. But I'm not going to bring them any closer together than that. Well, Platonic philosophy is a kind of mysticism. It more resembles a realization within yoga. Again, you see, I'm always hesitant to talk in this way because devotees have this tendency, oh! And then they'll go around saying, Sahotra Swami says Plato was a yogi. I don't say that. I don't intend to say that. But everyone likes to jump all the gaps, you know, and just bring everything together in a nice, neat package. And this is just what we're talking about. This is this tendency of the logical mind just to fit everything together in some system which no longer actually corresponds to the way things really are. But, you know, because we understand it, we like it. You know, it's just easy for our little brain to understand. But just in a very general way, what we read in what I've read about Plato reminds me of this Hiranyagarbha stage of realization. Hiranyagarbha meaning Garbha Dakshay Vishnu. And his form being the source, the transcendental source of the forms of this world. So Plato is concerned with the, he calls the realm of pure ideas. So this Hiranyagarbha, this is the Mahatattva. So these are the ingredients of creation, but they're at that stage of creation, this is a in a idealized form. You see, this is a manifestation of Vishnu's creative energies. But it is Brahma who's actually, taking those ingredients and producing the gross creation. So Socrates is the one that Plato writes about. He just quotes Socrates. So Socrates, through the writings of Plato, seems to have some sort of realization of this. And that's as far as I'll go. I'm not saying he was a yogi. I'm not saying he was, able to see Garbha Dakshay Vishnu or anything like that. Well, Schopenhauer was, he read the Upanishads and he read Buddhist literature, what was available at that time, in very, very poor translations. Actually, the Upanishads that were available in Europe at that time were translated from Persian. And the original Persian translation, the original Persian was a translation from Sanskrit, also a very poor translation. From Sanskrit into Persian, and then from that into European languages. So it was everything very approximate. So, but these philosophies were coming out at a time when the West was discovering India, discovering Indian Shastra, and beginning to translate them. So I'm not so much in favor of, again, some type of mechanistic historical explanation of all this. The Lord was arranging. The Lord was beginning, he was at that time setting the stage in the West for the appearance of this movement. And this is how it was developing. Yes?
You've kindly explained to us about various classical Buddhist schools. Now, Buddhism is becoming popular in the West. Do you have any idea what they believe in, or what kind of philosophy, if any, they subscribe to? I mean, they must subscribe to something, because they say they're Buddhists.
Yeah.
I mean, I know this is less interesting, but it relates to the world that we're living in and preaching in now.
Yeah. Well,
when you were describing that, I could just see that these are great for hippies.
Yes. You see, this
is a stream of consciousness. Nothing happens. Nothing is existent. Whatever is here now, what wasn't here a moment ago, it's here now. No responsibility.
I started today's class trying to show that Charvak and Buddhism, these are two sides of the mind's function. So Buddhism is pure mental plane, you see. And so people who are fascinated with the mind, and like you say, hippies, so they take drugs, the drugs are creating some sort of mirage, hallucination in the mind. They become all absorbed in that. Daydreaming and all this sort of thing, fantasizing. So Buddhism is a perfect recipe for people who are already very fond of mental speculation. And moreover, because Buddhism is mental plane philosophy, it in itself is subject, is freely, practically inviting to be interpreted any way you like. And that's what they do. So this Western Buddhism is really Western Buddhism. I've seen that when the I read about some different lamas from Tibet, or I guess they come from Dharamshala, really, because they fled. And they've gone to the West to teach. And one of them famously was a drunkard. He became a drunkard. And you know, and his disciples know it. I mean, it's not something like hidden because it's shameful. Just openly a drunkard. I was reading, there was a ceremony done in somewhere in America. So some Buddhist lamas had come together. I don't know if the, maybe even the Dalai Lama was there presiding over it. But it was some ritual that they were doing, and many, many Westerners, you know, Western students of Buddhism were there to see. And then this one Lama, the drunkard, who has started a school in Colorado, he came, you know, there's all these Lamas sitting there and chanting their Tibetan mantras. And then, so he walks up, and he recently, out of in a drunken fit, had broken his leg, had fallen down, and so he came hobbling up with a cast on his leg, again totally drunk on the stage, and he grabbed the microphone and he started haranguing the crowd. Don't be misled by all this nonsense you see here. So, yeah, the other, you know, monks were, well, they were good Buddhists, so they just kept doing what they're doing, you know, because that's all just illusion anyway, so. And he's telling everyone that this is Maya, and therefore they shouldn't be, you know, too fascinated with it. And then he went lurching off the stage. And when I read this, and it's amazing, the person who wrote it was like, isn't this just far out? And this is, you know, this is Buddhism. This is so such a wonderful religion. You know, you can be anything you want. You can even be a holy drunkard. And, you know, he just so totally spontaneous. And then I read another one lady who had become a disciple of a different Lama who had come to the West, come to San Francisco. She had, he died, so she had written a book of memoirs of her guru. And my guru, he was so open-minded and so interested in everything that at night he used to go into San Francisco City to the homosexual clubs and to the naked dance shows just to see everything going on. And he was so wonderful. Such a, you know, saintly person. And you know, I read this, I thought, well, you know, it's, everyone gets what they want. So, you know, in Asia at least, there is still, I read in Thailand, you were talking about Thailand, but there was one monk who had become quite popular, just a few years ago. But then it was found out that he was having affairs with different women. And so he was kicked out of his position. That was considered, you know. So in Asia at least, you know, there's still some respect for, in Buddhism, for the principles that Buddha has taught. But in the West, you know, it's just pure mind. You know, just the mind. And I've sometimes talked to these Western Buddhists, and it's like talking to, how to say, it's like a, yeah, well, it's like talking to a foolish child who has an adult's vocabulary. In other words, a child, you know, just... And the thing is, they think that that's good to be like that. You know, they really think that that's the essence. Just to float, you know, just floating around, and whether things connect properly or not, that's not important. But they're able to speak, you know, using an adult vocabulary. But what they say is so foolish, but laced with, you know, Buddhist ideas and terms. And yeah, like you say, there's really nothing to latch onto. It's so mental. Anything else? Oh, yes?
I heard that in Sri Lanka, the Buddhists are, the teachings of Buddhism is ahimsa, is the first and shunya. So in Sri Lanka, for example, all Buddhists are meat eaters. And I'm thinking, how is it they are justifying this idea?
Well, that you see, there's one example of the split between Hinayana and Mahayana. So the Mahayana Buddhists tend to adhere to vegetarianism. I'm not saying they all do, but that strong tendency is there. And in Hinayana or the Theravada, it's their understanding is that the monk, that the Buddha didn't want us to kill. This is the meaning of ahimsa, is don't kill. But if you have to go, as you're part of the Dharma as a monk, from door to door and beg with your wooden bowl. So if the householder you're begging from slaps a fish into your bowl, you didn't kill it, so you can eat it. So that's you're nonviolent. But in the Mahayana, then they understand that, you know, if you eat something that it was killed by someone else, that is also karma.
My little exposure to Buddhism is mostly from Thailand. So the philosophy there is that, of course, they're all meat eaters and all really horrible things. I mean, they have jars with live grasshoppers on the road, and they empty it into a big wok with hot oil. So you, and then people crunch. Hot, freshly fried grasshoppers who are alive a few minutes ago. For instance, it's a Thai delicacy. Not only times Chinese. So their idea is that if you don't kill it, it doesn't matter, you can eat anything. And they have, there's a small number of Muslims in Thailand who are the butchers.
Oh yes.
So it all goes on. And then a lot of people, they're not that concerned about, you know, if you happen to kill it yourself or something. A rat or a snake, and anyway, you should kill it, and then you might as well eat it too. Rats, snakes, all kinds of things. So,
I once visited the devotees in Burma. This was quite a number of years ago. And in Rangoon, I was staying because, under the laws of that country, a tourist has to stay in an approved guest house. So there was no question of me staying actually with the devotees. So I had to stay in a guest house. And that was in the center of Rangoon. Right near, there's this big pagoda. Shvetagon Pagoda, it's called.
Garden guest house.
You were there too?
So many times.
Yes. So the garden guest house. So just, I was just going out of the garden guest house around the corner. There's these Indians who live on the street next door. So I was just going there. And as I was going around the corner, a Buddhist monk came the other way. And he had a bat, you know, this flying rat, in other words, a big one, fruit bat, on a stick. And he was just biting into the wing. You know, I, like for a split second I saw it, and I just turned my head away and went, Hare Krishna. No, he was dead, but it was, you know, you could see the whole form of this thing. It was one of these big fruit bats.
Like pakora.
Yeah, like pakora. And he had it on a wooden stick, and he was just going, like, you know, to bite. And he was dressed up in those...
But there was in Thailand there was like the born again Buddhist, the Santiyaso.
Yes.
The government monks, that's why they like to dress in your, they were, well, the government approved monks dressing cloths like this, a little darker shade. But the Santiyaso, they were plain brown, and they're vegetarians. They only eat once a day. It takes them 1 hour to eat. And like that, they're born again Buddhists, and they have their monastery, and then you go in, and there's a nice picture of a nice, beautiful woman, and then you go to the, in a little bit further, and then there's a decomposed woman, dead body, just to show you the contrast. You see, and that's what they go and meditate on. So they're like, and they produce books, and they distribute them. And
fired up, yeah.
They're the born again Buddhists. They don't take milk products. Well, anyway, most people don't.
Garlands, too, they won't. Garlands are forbidden. Flowers, any of that sort of thing. Incense, even.
They are attracting some following because they're like real Buddhists. Whereas the regular monks, they are, so many of them, they'll have pin-ups in their cabin. And yeah.
I was in that
picture of a pretty girl.
I was in a Bangkok, in one of these big the big Buddhist shrines, not that really big one, but another one. And there's a lot of Buddhist monks sitting around. Yeah, they just sit around and talk nonsense, you know, and laugh. You can see them, some of them smoking. And I was just going around looking in the different, you know, they have different temples with Buddhist deities. And I happened to see there was a young woman in a miniskirt. She was in there in the compound. And she might have been... I don't know. She might have been a reporter or something. I think she had a camera or a notebook, and so she was looking very intently and taking notes and snaps. And so there were these two monks, and they were old too, quite old looking. And she walked in front of them, you know, looking around, and they'd been laughing, and then when they saw, it was like, wow, you know, they just were looking at her. I mean, not, and I was looking at them, like, you know, and they didn't care, you know, they're completely nonchalant about it. Here's a beautiful girl, let's look at her, you know. So I would think, what's the difference between them and anyone else? Just the robes. And Rotan?
Well, I heard an opinion about the Sadarshan divisions of philosophy, that this is just manifestation of different levels of
different levels of enviousness.
This was a statement by the South Indian gentleman, sometimes you often use it.
Well, I suppose that you can say that, But anyway, I just repeat what I said, that the original subject matter of these philosophies we find in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So the original subject matter, that is part and parcel of the Bhagavat Tattva. What philosophers have done to this subject matter is another thing. Yes, they have removed it from the source, and that is due to envy, that's true. But I wouldn't dismiss the subject matter as being the product of envy, since it's there in the Bhagavatam. Okay? Yes, Dhammasetu.
Can we say that all these transitions from one philosophy to another is just like a state of frustration, inner frustration.
These questions are getting very psychological. You can say that, I suppose, but these philosophies, they have their teachers, they have their tradition. Now, if you want to get very psychological and say one is, you know, they're manifestations of envy or frustration, I suppose you could do that too. These ingredients will be found there, I suppose, but you know, one thing is that if you have some idea in your mind that helps you understand an issue, you have to be very cautious about speaking it to others. If someone goes around and just says, the six systems of philosophy are just different manifestations of envy or frustration, you know, you may create an impression that you know, that you're being too dismissive, you know, that you've just put everything in a simple category for your own understanding and that's it. But after all, these are philosophies, and our acharyas, Baladev Vidyabhushan in his Govinda Bhashya, has gone to great length refuting these philosophies in detail. One can read this in Govinda Bhashya. He doesn't just say, oh, they're all frustrated or all they're envious. You know, that's, he could have done that in one line. This Gautama, Kanada, they were frustrated, they were envy. But actually he doesn't say that. In fact, what he says is that it may be that they were actually themselves deviated, although they were, he does acknowledge that they were sages. He says, but so he says that maybe that they were deviated themselves, or it may be that the Lord used them to introduce these philosophies into the world for the Lord's own purpose. Mm. Yes, Paul.
Now, at least until the time Baladev Vidyabhushan, these philosophies were prominent enough in the world that it was required to refute them. What happened?
Oh.
Where are the Nyayiks and the...
Well, they're still around in India, but you know, this philosophy requires a brain.
I mean, we find regular Mayavadis, yeah. Sri Vaishnavas, and Madhvas who subscribe to the philosophies of their school. At least I haven't found Nayakas and Sankhyas.
Yeah. But to some degree they're still around, but they have not had strong acharyas like Vedanta. There's a progression that the Vedanta is the last installment of these six systems, and so the Vedanta acharyas have been most powerful in establishing Vedanta and refuting all that went before. So, I have heard, I know from Indian godbrothers who have been around in India, that there are some persons who are, say, adhering to the Sankhya philosophy, and they're quite learned in it. I heard of one real strict Karma Mimamsa somewhere in the north, in the Garhwal region, doing all, you know, the duties of Karma Mimamsa Brahmana. But I think these persons are quite rare. So the Vedantacharyas established real mats, you know, real, they attracted followers, they set up systems, and Vedanta is actually the culmination. That's the philosophy itself looks back on all the others, whereas you see that then Mimamsa is really just looking back at the previous four, and then yoga is really just looking back at the previous three and like that. So Vedanta has the line on all of them.
Atato Brahma
Jivyasa. Yes.
After going through all that.
And they're in, you know, they're left in the lurch. They really don't have, I don't think they have real systematic arguments for fighting back. So they're just dwindling. There are those who adhere, still stick to the principles. I suppose it has to do with family line and all of that, the gotra,
yeah.
So they just maintain it that way, but they're not preachers, they're not.
You were just saying about monks also, that the institution serves a purpose. The mat is a place where the siddhanta and the
practice is preserved.
Of a particular school is preserved.
Yeah. Yes?
May I ask something different from the topic which was discussed today?
Yes.
It is sometimes said that the name of the Lord, he doesn't have any specific name, rather, according to his qualities and activities, he is given name. So, like Krishna is the name which means he is all attractive. So, there are different, in different languages, there will be different words used for this. So, then does that all words, Krishna,
no, Vedanta Sutra says all words, there's a sutra which clearly states all words are names of the Lord. Because this is the point in philosophy that philosophers find fascinating, is the power of words. I'm here making some sounds, or when we read written words, they're just marks on a page. How is it that this particular sound or this particular mark is generating in our minds an understanding? So there is really no mechanistic explanation for that. This is even known in Western philosophy. Even in Western, Wittgenstein. Ludwig Wittgenstein, and he was mainly a philosopher of language, and he started off in his young years as what is called a logical positivist, that everything should be explained mechanically. But as he got more and more into language and how it works, and he reflected on it, he ended up a mystic. He became a mystic, and he had still no explanation, actually, but he was admitting that there's something mystical going on, and that science can account for it. And his field of evidence for his position was language. So the point of Vedanta Sutra is that all words have amazing potency. Even if I say the word cat, it's just amazing when you think about it that I say this word, cat, and then in your mind you get an image of this particular furry animal. So why should that vibration cause you to think of that? So Vedanta Sutra is saying that there is a potency to shabda, to words, and that potency, is coming from Krishna. These persons who don't know Krishna, then they just end up mystics. It's coming from somewhere, some other platform, we don't know what it is. But the Vedic conclusion is that it comes from the personality of Godhead. So therefore that is there, that all words are names of God. But then, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, that there are different categories of names of God. So there's Gaunanam, there's Mukhyanam, there's also Madhuranam. So Gaunanam are the names, just as I gave the example, the names that pertain to this material manifestation. This is also manifested from the potency of the Lord. But those names that remain within this sphere, names of the Lord like Jagat Purush or Shrishtakarta, Shrishtikarta, like that. And ultimately, all words. So these are Gaunanam. Then Mukhyanam are the names that address the Lord Himself. And then Madhuranam are those special names that the Lord has endowed with the potency of sweetness so that His devotees can chant them, relish them, and in this way develop intimate relationship with Him. And the example Bhaktivinoda Thakur gives of Madhuranam is Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. So Hare Krishna and Rama, these are examples of Madhuranam. So these are three classifications. So you cannot equate cat with Krishna, the word cat with the holy name Krishna. Although even such a word like cat or dog or pencil is exhibiting some mysterious, you know, mysterious quality that, mysterious potency that big speculators admit is mystical. You know, cannot be explained by material, ordinary material relationships and interactions. Yes, Maharaj.
One time we were discussing in Chennai about the meaning of words and understanding of words. Just like even Mayavad is there in Gita, and Krishna said, Man Manava Mad Bhakto Mad. Six times he said, to me. But they understand this to me means to unborn. And ultimately they don't understand instruction. So same word is there, but their understanding is different, and ultimately there is a misunderstanding. So this is the problem.
Is that a question or an observation?
So if you would like to tell something about it, how to understand properly the meaning of the word. Because even if you say Krishna, well, you think of something unborn. And
Prabhupada speaks about that, that, again, using this Mukhya and Gauna terminology. So, this is this concern of Nyaya, is to establish the right definition and right usage of words. And so they have their rules, but of course this is because it's going on in the mental plane, therefore it can be juggled. You know, therefore someone who's becomes very expert in just the technique, the empty technique of manipulation of words, then he can juggle his own meanings out of the Shastra. This is the problem. So Srila Prabhupada explains that the Mayavadis, their thought process, their say value system, the very values that they accept in their process, this leads them to the Gauna definition of words, the secondary, you know, like the word cat. Again, you look in the dictionary, then the first meaning will be that, you know, Felix, whatever it is, Felix Pardis, or the Latin or Greek terminology, scientific terminology, little furry feline animal. But then a cat can be a gossipy woman. You know, that's a secondary meaning. She's a cat because she talks behind people's backs. Or cat can be a big machine that they use in building roads, with a front loader with a big scoop in the front for lifting big amounts of earth, because there's a company called Caterpillar, and so then that has been shortened to cat. So, so you can get a bunch of secondary definitions, even looking in a, you know, ordinary English dictionary. So in modern Western philosophy, they're the deconstructionists or the postmodernists. So this is their business. They take a piece of text. I'll give you an example. There's a French postmodernist philosopher called Jacques Derrida. And he, you see, they, these postmodernists consider their founder Acharya to be Friedrich Nietzsche. So he was taking Nietzsche's original manuscripts and going through them to read Nietzsche in his own right, because he wrote by hand. There was no typewriters then, or at least Nietzsche didn't have one. He didn't like to use them. So, and then he was, Derrida wanted to write some commentary, you know, to find, by looking in Nietzsche's manuscripts, the real essence of his philosophy, and write a commentary on that essence. So he was looking in the manuscript, and he found that in the margin, Nietzsche had written, because he wrote in German, obviously, being a German, "Wo ist mein Regenschirm?" which means, "Where's my umbrella?" And Derrida just, this is the sutra that expresses all of the Nietzschean philosophy. And he wrote a whole big interpretation of this. You know, it was just a note, "Where's my umbrella?" He probably, you know, wanted to go out later, and it was looked like it was going to rain. And he looked around, didn't see the umbrella, so he just wanted to remind himself that I should find my umbrella before I go out. You know, when I finish this page, I'll, you know, something like that. I'll finish this page and go out, but here I'll write on the same page, "Where's my umbrella? Remember to find..." That's probably why he wrote that. But Derrida made a whole philosophy out of this. So that means, you know, going to every word, "Where?" "Where" is a very metaphysical concept. "Where" means the whole cosmos and... And then is the essence of being. And then my means, you know, the ego and umbrella. All of our existence is under the umbrella of a total reality. Something like this. So, this is, it's called deconstructionism. You deconstruct the sentence. Means you take, an author has constructed a sentence, the deconstructionist comes along and takes it apart without regard to the author's intention at all. Takes it apart, takes word by word, look, you know, all kinds of different meanings from the dictionary or just his own imagination. And then, you know, comes up with a whole new meaning. And this is a big major school of philosophy today. And this is the Mayavadi process. The Mayavadis are the original classical deconstructionists. They have, Shankaracharya deconstructed Vyasadeva's Vedanta Sutra. And Prabhupada points out, and it's right there in Shankara's own commentary, that where Srila Vyasadeva has used the term parinama, that the creation has come by a transformation of the Lord's personal energy, Shankaracharya has written, it doesn't mean this at all. And he has even, in his commentary, criticized Vyasadeva for this choice of word. And in this way, he has argued his Vivartava, that it's all an illusion. Now, this is deconstructionism. You take something apart, written by another, you take it apart and reassemble it in your own way, you know, giving your whole meaning, own meaning, without regard to what he intended. And you're very, you know, self-assertive about this. Even if the author's still alive and protests, "I didn't mean that," doesn't matter what you meant. This is what the words you wrote say. You wrote them, but they said something else than you meant when you wrote them. That's what a parushaya means. This is a parushaya. Any meaning at all. No meaning meant by any person. You know, so I'm doing it now. And they can just go, they're empowered to just go on and on and on and on and on, blah blah, like that. No end to it. Nonsense.
People pay taxes to keep such people as professors in the university.
Therefore, again, you see this point of impersonalism. It's very interesting. It means mechanism. you know, impersonalism and the mechanistic conception are the same thing. So this is the problem with, you know, it goes right down to, again, you know, just language itself. That language obviously has a rather prominent mechanistic aspect. I mean, there's, you know, words in the dictionary, there are rules of grammar. So if one is an impersonalist, that means for different reasons, perhaps stupidity or perhaps malevolence, he has, you know, a really bad purpose. But they just take the words, how to say it, they're not concerned with the author's intention, what's behind the words, the intention behind the words. They take the words off the page. You see? They just take the words off the page. I think it was, you find in the Bible, there's some statement about the letter kills the spirit. There's some statement like that. It means that if one just becomes absorbed in grammar, dictionary meanings, and things like that, then you actually lose the spirit of the intention of the writer. And that's, so there is a certain kind of, you know, either some may be fools, they're just fools. Like you were giving an example of that Muslim who one should not go to the mosque. He just failed to turn the page. And it didn't cross his mind that, you know, wait a minute, how can this be an instruction? It didn't cross his mind. He just, the words on the page, that's it. The end of the page, that's it. Or someone, you know, more likely is a rascal. And so he wants to just, yes, the words on the page, never mind what's behind it. So I can screw up my own meaning. And so they in this way, they exploit the mechanistic aspect of language. So this is the same old thing. This is the same old syndrome of materialism. Just like there's this body. This body is a machine, yantra. But the body is simply the vehicle of the soul. But the rascal, the materialist, he wants to remove the soul, remove the spiritual element. Or at least nullify it, make it impotent, make it, you know, inconsequential. And the main thing that's happening is the body. The purpose of life, everything will be defined in terms of the body. So this is impersonalism, you see? You render the spiritual dimension either, you know, void, either really not there or there, but there's nothing you can say about it. It's there, but it's passive, it's, you know, and the real, you know, form and activity and all of that, that's the body. All right, so we have a couple minutes left.
I would like to ask, what is the predominant philosophy in Buddha thing, actually?
Well, in the Buddhist records, because the Buddhists have their own historical records from that time, so they the impression one gets from reading those is that, and it's understandable because that was Kali Yuga, the beginning of Kali Yuga. So, as I mentioned, also concerning the six systems, they had all become very quarrelsome. So, in the Buddhist records, they say there were 62 different schools of philosophy in India at the time the Buddha appeared. So, you know, starting with six, I suppose, and then they, you know, argued and divided. And they were just spending their time arguing. And so the common people who are looking to these brahmanas for spiritual leadership had become disappointed with him because they were just engaged in finger-pointing and debate and denouncing one another. And so this is the impression one gets, that there was this, there's this nice English word, lacuna, which means there was like an emptiness. You know, people were dissatisfied and they didn't know what to do. They had lost faith in the brahmanas, but probably weren't saying it aloud, but inside they felt this. And then Buddha came and he could sweep them all up. And this is why, this is another point, this is why it's important, you know, in considering Buddhism, to appreciate that the Buddha himself did not really teach a philosophy. Because his attitude to all that, that debate among the brahmanas, was just, this is all nonsense. You see, this all fit together with his teaching that the Vedas are not transcendental. They're the product of human intelligence. So therefore, all these arguments that they're having about the Vedas, it's all a big waste of time. So this was very, you know, a very important aspect of what he taught, that the real point of this life is to end suffering. These are the Four Noble Truths. So suffering can be removed. This is the Nirodha again. Nirodha. So this is the goal of his philosophy, of his teaching. And his teaching is to that end of ending suffering is largely it's ethical or moral. To realize the Four Noble Truths, there's the Eightfold Noble Path. Those eight parts of that path are just, they're just concerned with what we should do and what we should not do.
You look more like political leader.
Well, moral, ethical leader. Prabhupada says Buddhism is an upadharma, sub-religious principle. So this means moral. And you know, the main principle of that morality is ahimsa, non-violence. Don't kill. Stop the sacrifices. When you consider it, you can see his weaponry for getting people to reject the Vedic culture. That these Brahmins are just arguing, coming to no conclusion, and in the meantime they're engaged in animal slaughter. They're you know, senseless animal killers and talking so many things without realization. So who should listen to? You can see if that was going on, then it was a very sort of, you know, opportune moment for Buddhism to come into its own. And so people were frustrated, and so they accepted that. But as Buddhism spread and became a big movement, and then after Buddha left in particular, then there was need for a doctrine, there was need for a theology or philosophy to answer questions. Everyone was sort of like under the influence of Lord Buddha, who is Krishna. You know, they were just under his influence and accepting everything very faithfully. And then when he departed, then it is said that's when the doctrinal disputes began. Within a few days after his departure, there was already one split. And then they were trying to have what are called, they called sanghas, to try to, you know, to clarify the doctrine and have one Buddhism. And the third sangha was called by Maharaj Ashok. This was a couple centuries after the Buddha. So the monks themselves had tried two sanghas and failed. And because they were monks, you know, then being monks and being Buddhists, they didn't do anything about it. So, you know, the different ideas expanded and expanded and expanded, and they just tried to get along. But then Ashok, Kshatriya, he wanted to establish Buddhism as his the state religion of his kingdom. So he, you know, he wanted things to be made very clear. So he called them together, and it was sort of, you know, under threat. Now, he presented them with a list of questions. He said, I want these questions answered. You guys, you know, you just keep talking, and your doctrine keeps multiplying, and, you know, one is seeing that one of you is saying this, and over here another one is saying the exact opposite, and you're all supposedly following the Buddha. So this is not satisfying to me. I can't run a kingdom under under this type of chaos, doctrinal chaos. So then when he really put pressure on them, then they came up with a definition of Buddhism. And then it said, then there were many who were outside, who left outside. And they continued on in their way. So in this way, just... And then within the accepted doctrine, they kept on dividing anyway, as time went on. Yeah, so really the philosophy of Buddhism came after the Buddha. And it's all just mental speculation. Because it's material, you find the same trends, these four schools. They're in the Western philosophy too. Direct realism, representationalism, subjective realism, and voidism. There's Western versions of that. Yes?
From different sources, I heard that this Buddha which appeared...
This question. Oh, yeah. I know. I already know what you're going to ask.
Yes. For me, it's not clarified at all. So I just want to know. is it this Buddha is sorted among these Dashavatars or not?
Well, if we accept Srila Prabhupada as our acharya and we accept his books as tattva, then that Buddha that appeared in Nepal at Lumbini, who is, you know, well known here in India, the historical Buddha, so to speak, that is the Buddha mentioned in the Dasavatars. Srila Prabhupada is quite clear on that. So yeah, from other sources there is some question about that. But the interesting thing is that even this comes up in Buddhism itself. This is again the one of the issues between the Hinayana and Mahayana. The Hinayana are the, you know, that Buddha, historical Buddha, that is the Buddha. The Mahayana say that Buddha, what they call the Nirmanakaya Buddha, the Buddha in the human body, was teaching only external truth for the people in general. And then they say there are other forms of Buddha. The Sambhogakaya Buddha, who is in heaven. And then finally the Dharmakaya Buddha, who is like a Buddhist Paramatma. Again, it doesn't get off the mental plane, but they have some idea of a Buddha who is... they have one name, Mahavairocham, the great sun Buddha or shining Buddha. Just like Surya Narayan. So apparently they were influenced in their thinking by Pancharatrik doctrine. So anyway, Mahavairochan, he's the ultimate metaphysical Buddha. And his teachings are esoteric and go much, much farther than the teachings of the earthly Buddha, Nirmanakaya Buddha. And those who follow this, who are scholars of this, like there's a school of this esoteric Buddhism in Japan, Shingon Buddhism. It's rather interesting because of all forms of Buddhism, that's the one that seems to be closest to, again, in a mental way, to Krishna consciousness. And the scholars who write about this, Shingon Buddhism, they say it's theistic. They use this term, theistic. And the Japanese Acharya, founder Acharya of the school of Buddhism, Kukai his name was, he says this doctrine of the original Buddha, the Sun Buddha, was not taught by the earthly Buddha, but it is revealed in, they have esoteric scriptures apparently that are supposed to have been entrusted, the Buddha, they were entrusted to the Nagas, you know, the snakes in the underworld, the celestial serpents. And so these esoteric scriptures are coming from the Nagas. And so there's this ultimate Buddha whose form encompasses the whole universe, and he's effulgent, and he's transcendental, and he's a person. And he's the, you know, his consciousness is the basis of everything. So from what I've heard about this, what you have said, that there are those who say that the, I guess it's some Gaudiya, from Gaudiya Vaishnava source, that the historical Buddha was not the Buddha and did not teach the real Buddhism. But this is you find the same thing in among the Buddhists themselves.
Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur speaks of Shakya Singh. Mostly when he refers to Buddha, he says Shakya Singh. And then this one of his, I think it's a disciple of Ananta Vasudeva, Govardhan Das, he wrote a lot of books. So he gets into all that, that the Gautam Buddha and Shakya Singh.
Well, historically, yes, Shakya Singh, the lion of the Sakya dynasty. So the historical Buddha is said to have appeared in the Sakya dynasty, which is also in the some line of Gautama. So he...
somehow they make some
distinction. Yeah, they make some distinction. But Prabhupada didn't make the distinction. And the same distinction is there in Buddhism too, some at least doctrinal distinction. I mean, they don't say that the earthly Buddha is some imposter. They don't say that. But they say that what he taught was not the real Buddhism. He was only teaching at a very elementary level for the sake of the whole population. But the real Buddhism is something esoteric and one has to go beyond. Anyway. There's not much profit of being too much concerned about these.
So many different varieties of zero.
Yeah. Okay, so it's after 12:30. We stop here. Hare Krishna. Maybe I could get some feedback back now about how we should proceed. I could go into Western philosophy, or we could talk more about, go into more detail in the philosophies we talked about today. Actually, I left something out also, but I'll cover that tomorrow. There was different forms of worship, because we want to talk about philosophy and religion. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur has explained there are five different types of worship that go on the material platform. So we'll talk about that tomorrow in the beginning. But what do you think? Should we pursue these issues more deeply, or should we go into modern philosophy, Western philosophy?
Well, I won't be here.
But you won't be here, yes.
I was thinking like the modern philosophy of science. That would be... I mean, just like by describing this Buddhism, you just want to vomit and you understand it's just complete nonsense.
But when you go into the modern philosophy of science, you also come to the same...
Yeah, well, that's what we want.
And you'll vomit then too.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. When you describe it, then we can... Prabhupada just said rascals and fools, and we're getting a comprehensive picture of why they're just rascals and fools. Mm. So it's good.
Yeah. See, this
by describing it, you just understand what complex nonsense it is. Yeah. Just completely garbage.
This Vedic Indian version of philosophical systems that we heard today, I find is a very useful. It's sort of a universal markers of the mental plane. And then when you come to Western philosophy, because in Western philosophy there is no such, you know, really final authoritative categorization. It's all so opinionated. One book of philosophy will explain Western philosophy this way, another book will explain it a different way. And it actually becomes sort of, you know, very daunting, very scary, you know, because you're really never sure of what's going on. But with this, the six systems of Vedic philosophy, Charvak, Buddhism, and then also these, in addition, the five forms of worship, which also have a philosophical content to them by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And then you have very nice categories, and you can fit everything else that's going on in the West into these categories. So this is useful, very useful. So that's basically what I'll be doing when I talk about science, etc., in the West, pointing out the similarity of those and these. So Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.